This week on Health Justice Radio, we'll be discussing the results of the Canadian general election held 2 weeks ago, on May 2nd. When the election was called, many in the media were calling it the election nobody wanted. However, the election resulted in a change from a minority conservative government to a majority conservative government. The Liberals lost official opposition status to the NDP, the Bloc Québécois lost almost all of their seats, and the Greens won their first seat. It may have been the election nobody wanted, but the change in Parliament will be far from inconsequential. Today, Nikki and I will look at the implications of a federal conservative majority government on health care in Canada. We'll be talking to Dr. Gordon Guyatt from McMaster University. Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3. Before we get into the healthcare implications of the new government, I'll give a brief overview of how the government is formed in Canada and what powers the elected government has. The legislature in Canada is bicameral. This means that it consists of two houses, the Senate and the House of Commons. Each group of politicians can introduce bills, but in practice, the Senate serves primarily as, in the words of Sir John A. Macdonald, a place of sober second thought, providing revisions to bills rather than introducing them. The members of the Senate are appointed on suggestion of the Prime Minister, but the members of Parliament of the House of Commons are elected. There are 308 seats in the House of Commons. Each seat represents an electoral division or riding. Canadians of voting age who live in the riding can vote for a candidate. Candidates can be affiliated with a registered party, and each party can field up to one candidate in each riding. The candidate with the most votes becomes the MP with a seat in the House of Commons. This method of electing MPs is called first past the post, and this system does not require a political party to have a majority of the votes across the country to win a majority of the seats. This election, less than 40% of voters cast a ballot for the Conservative candidate, yet they hold about 54% of the seats, and thus votes in the House. When a party earns a majority of seats, it will form the government. The leader of the party, elected by the party, becomes the Prime Minister, and various ministers are chosen from the MPs of that party. If no party wins more than half of the 308 seats, then it is called a minority government. The party that forms the government will need to have support from another party. The party with the most seats usually forms governments, but this is not necessarily the case. Two or more parties can join together in a coalition and effectively have a majority government if they have enough seats together. Members of Parliament are free to vote any way they want when it comes to supporting the House or passing bills, but in practice, MPs of a given party tend to vote the same way. From this it follows that in a majority government, the governing party can effectively pass any bill in the House. Since it has a majority of the votes, if it votes to pass a bill, the bill will pass the House. If it votes against it, the bill will not be passed. In a minority government, it's a different story. To pass a bill, there needs to be more than 50% of the vote, but since no party has enough votes on its own, the bill needs the support from at least one other party. Prior to the election, the Conservative Party could not pass any bills without the support of any of the Liberal Bloc or New Democratic parties. However, now that the Conservatives have a majority, they can pass bills without the support of any other party. So in this respect, the NDP, despite more than doubling their seats, have less power than before the election.
In studio, or on the phone with us, is Dr. Gordon Guyatt. He's a physician researcher at McMaster, and he's also the co-founder of the Medical Reform Group. Welcome to the show, Dr. Guyatt.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Great. So we heard that Harper has committed to maintain the annual 6% increase in funding after the healthcare accord with the provinces expires in 2014. But he also alluded to the fact that he wouldn't stop provinces who were interested in exploring alternate systems of delivery. Can you explain for us what you think that means?
Well, first of all, to understand it, it's worth noting what the Canada Health Act says and how governments have responded to their responsibilities with respect to the Canada Health Act. So the Canada Health Act was instituted at a time when, back in the mid-80s, there was a major expansion of direct charges to patients. And in Ontario, for instance, 20% of the doctors were what was then called opted out of OHIP and were charging patients directly. And what the Canada Health Act said is that the government can penalize provinces that allow direct charges to patients for insured services. And following the passage of the Canada Health Act, legislation was passed in a number of provinces, in one way or another in every province, that basically stopped direct charges to patients for insured services. For well over a decade, that held fast, and the government, when there were charges, did penalize people. What has happened over getting pretty close to 10 years now, neither the Liberal government nor the current Conservative government have been willing to penalize provinces. And indeed, the penalties to the provinces have gone down, 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 at the same time as which direct charges to patients for insured services has gone up, up, up. So it differs across provinces, but you have direct charges to patients for things like joint replacement, or clinics that produce joint replacement, cataract surgery, diagnostic testing, MRI and CT scans, and patients are getting, on a large scale, charged directly, and the federal government is not penalizing the provinces. So what you have is a sort of creeping privatization from that point of view. Then there is a second issue is whether there is for-profit delivery of care. So one of the phenomena that we've seen is large for-profit providers coming in and setting up what are in effect small hospitals for things like joint replacement and cataract surgery, and governments are allowing this to happen, and once again the federal government is standing by and letting this happen. So basically what Harper has done is to announce officially a policy that has in fact been in place for some time, which is allowing creeping privatization and not doing anything about it.
Do you think that the push for privatization is economically driven or value driven? And I mean, like, is it because the system with private funding is believed to be more efficient, or because the belief that people who can afford to pay should have the right to a better service?
Perhaps both. It is difficult for anybody to stand up in public and say, for politicians in any case, to stand up in public and say people who pay should get better, quicker care. That remains politically, I would say, politically unacceptable. A lot of people have speculated about what Mr. Harper really feels versus what he says in public, looking at what the sort of statements he made 10 years ago before he got back into partisan politics with the Conservative Party. But what he actually believes, who knows? But there are certainly, I am sure, people in government, in the Conservative Party, and people in business who believe that people should, if you are wealthy and can pay, you should get quicker, higher quality care. But as I say, that's not a statement that can be made publicly very comfortably, and so this goes under this is masked by a suggestion that care can be delivered more efficiently by for-profit providers than not-for-profit providers. As it turns out, the evidence is that on average the for-profit care is poorer quality and more expensive.
During the election campaign, some people said that the role of the federal government in healthcare is small and just related to funding, that healthcare is not really a federal issue. How important is the role of the federal government in shaping healthcare in Ontario?
Well, it's been perhaps somewhat ironic that indeed the Canadian Constitution says that healthcare is a provincial mandate, except for armed forces and native health, really very small areas. But historically, the federal government has been a huge player in healthcare. So it is the federal government, and the way the federal government has done it is by using financial leverage. So we wouldn't have a national Medicare program had it not been for a federal initiative that said if provincial governments set up a healthcare system that met certain criteria, the federal government would pay half. And that is what led to Medicare as we know it today with respect to physician and hospital services. And then subsequently, when there was erosion of universality, the federal government brought in the Canada Health Act, which then allowed the government to withdraw funding from provinces if they allowed direct charges to patients for insured services, and for a time it stopped that. So the federal government historically has been a big player, and the Canadian public, I think, expects the federal government to be a big player. Well, they do. There's no question in terms of ensuring high quality services. I don't think the current federal government is philosophically committed to that, but politically they have to make a claim that they are. So there is a big potential for the federal government to play a role. Both the prior Liberals and the current Conservatives have limited their role to handing out money. They have done very little in terms of activism, a little bit in terms of trying to reduce waiting lists, but really basically handed out money and left the way things are run to the provinces.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a little bit about the Conservatives, the Liberals. Obviously, the NDP for some time now has placed healthcare as one of its very important campaign pillars. You previously ran as the NDP candidate in the riding of Ancaster, Dundas, Flamborough, and Westdale. What's your reaction to the NDP becoming the official opposition, and what do you think this will mean for Canadian healthcare?
Well, I'm, as a former NDP candidate, I'm delighted with the success of the NDP. And the question is whether one, as when one is a minor party, one has more freedom to say things that are based on principle instead of pragmatic. And so it'll be interesting to see what the NDP does now that they are the official opposition. Still, of course, they are facing a majority government, and that limits their influence. But clearly one of the reasons that I ran for the NDP is that, as I've described to you, the Liberals were not much better than the Conservatives have been in terms of enforcing the Canada Health Act and trying to ensure universal equitable care, and the NDP has said that they would. It will be interesting for instance, how much the NDP makes or can make enforcement of the Canada Health Act an issue, and how much pressure they can put in the government to take an active role in maintaining universality, which I think Mr. Harper's announcement of leaving things to the provinces reflects his disinclination to try and do anything active, and his willingness to let the creeping privatization continue and expand.
Looking at the polls right now, it looks like the PC government will defeat the Liberals in the upcoming Ontario provincial election in October. What would the implications of two Conservative governments negotiating the Health Act in 2014 be?
Well, the implications are, well, the provinces still need money. There's no I don't think the provincial conservative government, it would not be in their interest, nor would it be politically feasible to say, oh, it's okay, we're ready to accept a decrease in the funding for health care from the federal government. Everybody wants to balance their budget, and so I think there's a lot to worry about with respect to health care if one believes in universal, equitable, efficient, not-for-profit delivered care with federal and conservative governments. But I don't think one has to worry about a provincial conservative government taking the heat off the federal government in terms of transfer payments.
So we talked about there is this creeping for-profit delivery system. What kind of things, how will that impact, I guess, the broader Canadian healthcare system?
Well, what you're going to see as that happens, the evidence is quite strong that the for-profit delivery is, on average, produces lower quality care and is more expensive. So you're going to see less efficient delivery of care from for-profit providers, and that further will push the pressures on healthcare in terms of expenditures. And you'll see people starting to get charged more, and you'll see the emergence of two-tier care, where people who can pay will be at the front of the line and people who can't will be at the back of the line.
And I mean, in terms of like a time frame, like how quickly could that shift happen?
I think there is it's got to happen behind the scenes in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's been what the people who are pushing it have learned is that, you know, 10 years ago or 5 to 10 years ago, knowing that governments were not going to, were disinclined to limit them and were inclined to let the expansion of that sort of care, they made a big fuss when they made it public, they made it obvious, they went to the press and so on, they gave interviews saying, here's what we're doing. Well, that pushed governments, even though they were, I think, actually disinclined to limit the expansion of the for-profit delivery. But the public got upset at this. So you repeatedly had these scenes where the governments would intervene to limit this. Well, they learned, although they might have, they would have liked to have it as official policy, what they learned is be quiet, don't tell anybody, just do it, keep it under the radar. That doesn't, then it won't make the politicians uncomfortable, and we can just expand. And that's what happened the last 5 years. So you don't see it in the news, you don't see any of the people who are doing it, except for Brian Day out west. He's the only one continuing to take a high profile line. But everybody else is doing it very quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And for the time being, at any rate, it will have to continue to be done quietly because basically the Canadian public opposes it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can't go too quickly in that it has to stay under the radar.
So we're seeing an increasing move towards austerity measures at the local level, and I guess most obviously in Rob Ford's City of Toronto. What will austerity measures across the board kind of look like, and how will they affect, I guess, the health of Canadians, even if they're not directly targeted at healthcare?
Well, we know that there are large gradients in health between higher income folks and lower income folks. And if, for instance, you brought the health up to of the lower-income Canadians to the health that high-income Canadians enjoy, it would be have the equivalent health impact of curing cancer. So huge socioeconomic gradients in health. What we've seen in Canada in the last decade or so more than that have been growing gap between the haves and the have-nots, between the higher-income folk and the lower-income folk. And that has adverse health effects. And when you see government austerity programs, what you're seeing is decrease in public services, decrease in income supplementation for the poor, and the increasing gap in wealth between the haves and the have-nots, and that inevitably has negative health consequences.
Mm-hmm. And do you see that reflected at all here in Hamilton?
Yeah, Hamilton's one of actually the poorest cities in Canada, and if you look at the the health gradients in Hamilton, you have neighborhoods where, if you look at the lifespan and so on, it's low-income country lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really, within Hamilton is a good example of these huge gradients in health that go along with gradients in wealth.
Mm-hmm. So you are speaking at the upcoming conference hosted by Students for Medicare called Health is Always in the Headlines. Can you tell us a bit about what you'll be talking about there?
Well, what I'll be talking about largely is the evidence that I've made these statements that the evidence indicates that for-profit delivery is, in fact, ends up being lower quality, having poorer health outcomes, and is more expensive. And I'm going to present the evidence that substantiates those statements.
Great. We look forward to that conference. It's on May 28th from 12 to 4:30 p.m. And if you're interested in registering, you can do so at studentsformedicare.ca. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Dr. Guyot.
My pleasure.
Great. Take care. So that was an interview with Dr. Gordon Guyot. He's a physician researcher here at McMaster, and he's credited with having coined the term evidence-based medicine. He's also the co-founder of the Medical Reform Group and was a former candidate for the NDP in the Ancaster-Dundas-Flamborough-Westdale riding. You are listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. My name is Nikki, and on the board is Eric Brown. And before we start with some music, I guess we'll just have a little debrief about what Dr. Guyot said. Were you surprised at all by any of his answers, Eric?
I'm not particularly surprised. I mean, my favorite question was when I asked about whether he thought it was privatization is motivated by moral values, that the belief that you deserve better health care if you have money, or economic values. And he kind of said that, well, it's under the false pretense of economic values because the evidence for the economic benefits of privatization just aren't there. In fact, it's the opposite. So it must be moral values, but that's too controversial to talk about in public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the most important things to take from Dr. Guyot's talk is always that Canadians really do stand behind their healthcare, and that when they have the facts, and they really do want to believe in the system, and I think we all want to believe in the system and that it can work. And I think that Dr. Guyot just really has the evidence to show that that is the best way. So we'll wrap up now. Again, you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU. Have a great week.
See you later. Thanks a lot, guys.